Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. Beets are a nutritional gold mine, full of antioxidants and nutrients, but they're a mess to prepare. So just mix Super Beets with 4 ounces of water and boost circulation, relax arteries, and maintain healthy blood pressure. Get the Dr. Hoffman special offer at intelligentbeets.com. That's intelligentbeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we have a very special guest. Actually, he's a return guest because he graced our airwaves recently talking about his fantastic book, Cholesterol Clarity. He's one of my favorite interviewees because he is very proficient at getting the message across. In fact, he is also a very prolific podcaster. We'll tell you a little bit about his media involvement as well so that you can follow him via social media and via listening to his very informative podcasts. He is now the author of a breakthrough new book called Keto Clarity. That's K-E-T-O, as in ketosis, your definitive guide to the benefits of a low-carb, high-fat diet. Oh, perish the thought. How could that possibly be healthy? Well, we're going to talk about that with today's guest, Jimmy Moore. Jimmy is a layperson, but a very, very informed and medically wonky layperson because he's done a lot of investigative journalism on the subject of diet. He's teamed up with a top physician, Dr. Eric Westman, who is Associate Professor of Medicine at Duke Health in Durham, North Carolina. And Dr. Westman is well known as an individual who's done a lot of work validating the low-carb diet, in fact, collaborating with the late, great Dr. Robert Atkins to turn around the whole scientific paradigm about what works for weight loss and cardiovascular prevention. But here we're talking about keto. And so, Jimmy, welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. It's a pleasure having you once again on our airwaves.
Medically wonky. I do believe that's the first time I've been described that way.
No, because, I mean, do you accept that accolade? Because
absolutely, yeah.
Because you have delved into this issue with great passion and precision, and I think you've really come up with some breakthrough information. Of course, you yourself are a living N-of-1 study on the benefits of the ketogenic diet. So perhaps share with our listeners who may not be familiar with your story about how you got into this.
Sure. So back in 2003, I weighed 410 pounds, was wearing size 62-inch waist pants, 5XL shirts, on 3 prescription medications for high cholesterol, high blood pressure, breathing problems. I was a literal ticking time bomb at the age of 32. And it was at Christmas that year, my mother-in-law, God bless her, gave me a copy of Dr. Atkins' New Diet Revolution book. And I had tried low-fat diet this, run on the treadmill that. I'd done literally every diet known to mankind. Most of them were predicated on lowering calories and exercising more. And none of those were ever sustainable for me. So my dear mother-in-law gives me this book, and she'd given me books every year. But this one was kind of different because I read the book and I went, okay, eat less carbohydrate. Okay, doesn't this guy know this is where you get your energy from? Eat more fat. Doesn't he know that's going to make you fat and give you clog your arteries and give you heart disease? But I had surmised in my mind at 410 pounds, I needed to do something very desperately or I would be in big trouble very soon. And so January 1st, 2004, I embarked on the Atkins diet. First month, I lost 30 pounds. That was cool. Second month, I lost another 40 pounds. And by the end of 100 days, I'd lost 100 pounds. And it was at that point.
Wow, that is really impressive. 100 pounds in 100 days. We seldom see results like that in the diet world.
Well, and I was shocked, quite frankly, because I had seen weight loss before doing those low-fat diets, but what I had not seen was the steady weight loss that I saw on this one, and then simultaneously hunger control, cravings going away. I used to feel like I needed to, you know, quote, cheat when I was on a low-fat diet, but I kind of felt like I was cheating having steak with butter on top and some broccoli on the side. That was kind of cheating to me because you can't have butter usually on a diet, but this one I did. And so the end of that year, I did end up losing a total of 180 pounds, and it really obviously revolutionized my life, gave me a whole new career, as you said, medically wonky. I would call maybe a little nerdy about this now, but trying to educate the lay public because, quite frankly, a lot of doctors have let us down. And if the doctors aren't going to lead the charge, then by golly, a patient advocate is going to lead the charge. And so that's kind of my role now, I feel like, in this world, is to empower patients to take back control of their own health when the medical establishment has let us down.
Well, you know, speaking of doctors, we in medical school learned early on that ketosis was actually a very dangerous medical state, that it would, you know, puts people in peril of their lives. And we identified it with a very serious complication of diabetes called diabetic ketoacidosis, which is a medical emergency. Patients can die. And so the general view in the world of medical nutrition about ultra-low-carb diets is, okay, yeah, maybe it's a sleight of hand. You can lose some weight. Pounds will melt off, but you're going to die.
Right.
You know, it's like you're in a fool's paradise because you're causing major organ failure, and you're going to get a heart attack or a stroke or some calamitous thing will happen to your liver, and ultimately you know, you'll be a skinny corpse. That, I mean, that frankly is the general way that this has been portrayed.
That is the belief, yep. So unfortunately, it's dead wrong because, and this point was so prescient that we didn't just say it once. We didn't just say it twice. I think we ended up doing like 7 or 8 times throughout Keto Clarity to remind people this is not dangerous. Nutritional ketosis is a totally different thing than diabetic ketoacidosis, and here's a real easy way for people to understand that. Diabetic ketoacidosis can only happen if you are a type 1 diabetic or a type 2 who has lost all beta cell function. In other words, you don't make any insulin at all. Those are the only people that need to be concerned about it. If you don't fall in that category, guess what? You can't get diabetic ketoacidosis. But here's the kicker. Even if you're a type 1 or a type 2 with no beta cell function, you still can do nutritional ketosis because diabetic ketoacidosis results from a high carb intake but not taking insulin to cover those carbs. So your blood sugar precipitously rises well above 240, and then your body thinks it's starving. So
right.
It starts raising the blood ketones as well. Go ahead.
To paraphrase, it's like sugar everywhere, but not a drop to drink. Because
right.
Your body cannot utilize all that sugar. It mounts to fantastic levels in the bloodstream, but it can't enter the cells because of the lack of insulin. So this is not going to be, in a normal, physiologically sound person, a risk.
And definitely not in someone who's eating a low-carb diet. Diabetic ketoacidosis just doesn't come into the picture.
And incidentally, I recently attended the opening of an exhibit. It was a couple of years ago at the New York Historical Society. It was actually sponsored by one of the big drug companies that makes insulin.
Surprise.
But actually, they had historical documents and records literally showing the diaries of children who had type 1 diabetes before the advent of insulin. And they were meticulous about counting their carbs and making sure that they were on a high-fat, very low-carbohydrate, moderate protein diet to survive their diabetes, their type 1 diabetes.
Right. Even before they knew it was ketones that was present, they mm-hmm. knew instinctively that that was the way to control it, right?
Yeah. I mean, their lifespan was limited. They had a lot of problems, but that was the only known way to control type 1 diabetes.
And it stands to reason, too. I mean, anything that would raise insulin or raise blood sugar levels, especially in a type 1 diabetic, they don't make any insulin, is a bad thing. So you want to cut down on the blood sugar. You've got to cut carbohydrates, and then cutting protein, this has kind of been the shocking part for a lot of people reading Keto Clarity, is they had no idea that there was a glucose effect happening from consuming too much protein. And Dr. Atkins, for all the great work that he did, I think that was the major mistake that he made, was he said, okay, cut your carbs. That was great. But then he said, eat unlimited fat and protein. So what did our fat phobic society do obediently? They started eating chicken breast, thinking it was a health food. And unfortunately, right. Chicken breast is way too lean to do a ketogenic diet. That excess protein becomes sugar through this long G word, gluconeogenesis. And that causes problems in people trying to be a sugar burner, especially for a type 1 diabetic. Glucose, the presence of glucose raises blood sugar. So not a good thing.
Well, that's an interesting point, is that there are gluconeogenic amino acids that can be converted by the body into sugar. And so the point is to somewhat limit protein, put patients on an ultra-low protein regimen, but to consume moderate protein and use fat as the main source of calories and also for satiety purposes.
And which is silly that a lot of the headlines that get put out there of low-carb, high-protein.
It's the basis of diets like the South Beach diet,
right.
Which is a diet where it's called triangulation. It's sort of like what politicians sometimes do. It's two extreme positions. They take the middle position. This guy said, I forget his name.
Agatston.
Yes, Dr. Agatston down there in Florida said, okay, the Atkins diet is too much fat in that. Let's make it a lower fat, higher protein diet. And we do recognize that carbohydrates should be limited, but we'll allow some. And he came up with sort of a wishy-washy diet that helps some people, no question, because whenever you restrict something, people are bound to lose some weight, but it's not as dramatically successful as a true ketogenic diet.
And not as satisfying, which is why the fat is such a key in this whole thing. If you start cutting the fat, you take away the benefits that a low-carb diet can give you.
Right. Okay, so it's great for weight loss, but what I think is fascinating about the book Keto Clarity is that you enumerate a whole series of conditions that one might not suspect would be amenable to a ketogenic diet. So why don't you rattle off some of those conditions?
Yeah, so that was one of the reasons we wanted to write this book, was quite frankly, nobody had ever articulated, you know, all the myriad of benefits beyond weight loss and beyond epilepsy. Those were kind of the two things. And then you articulated the type 1 diabetes way back when. But I mean, there's so many myriad of great benefits to this, things that we have strong evidence for. So in chapter 16, you know, we go through all the things we have very strong evidence for, things like PCOS, the polycystic ovarian syndrome.
Which is a condition of overweight and excess bodily hair, infertility, irregular periods. For our listeners who don't know what that is, polycystic ovaries. Also often associated with insulin resistance, overweight, and prediabetes, and ultimately full-blown diabetes.
Exactly. That non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is a big one as well.
Yep.
That one's actually gotten a lot of attention because there's been some negative headlines about high-fat diets causing that, but what we're learning is it's actually sugar that's causing that.
Yeah, it's and primarily the form of sugar that we now massively have injected into our diets, which is fructose, particularly bad for the liver.
Yeah, and it, ubiquitous, literally, in all of our food supply.
You know, salad dressings, soda drinks.
Ketchup, that was the one that shocked me the first time I ever saw high fructose corn syrup in ketchup. I'm like, why? Heartburn is another one. IBS, I mean, on and on and on, diabetes and weight loss, as you mentioned. So that's the things we have, like, very strong evidence for a ketogenic diet. Then in chapter 17, we talk about the good evidence, the things we have, like, up to 1 year, things like Alzheimer's disease and dementia, like Dr. David Perlmutter has been talking about with his Grain Brain books, very prescient right now. And I think we're going to see a lot more in the coming years on that. Schizophrenia, bipolar, mental illness, really all the brain health issues. And when I tested this over a year very publicly on my blog, that was the thing that kind of shocked me the most. I didn't realize all the brain health benefits that ketones were going to provide me. And it was fascinating to me. And so it's kind of cool in the research of this, most of the things we have pretty good evidence for had to do with your brain and brain health.
And hence you call it Keto clarity, and that's a double entendre because you want to clarify misconceptions about the ketogenic diet, but also the ketogenic diet provides a lot of people with mental focus and clarity. And so could you explain in simple lay terms why a fat-based diet could be more beneficial for a wide variety of brain disorders, ranging from epilepsy to dementia, Alzheimer's disease, and so on?
Sure. So you caught the keto clarity part. That was good. So, yeah, I think the big thing is fuel. How are you fueling your body? And how does your body, and specifically we're talking about the brain here, how does it prefer to be fueled? And we argue in keto clarity, it would prefer to be fueled by fat and ketones. So the only way you can feed it that way is to shift your body from being that sugar burner over to being the fat burner. So when you reduce your carbohydrates to your personal tolerance level, moderate down the protein like we just talked about earlier to your personal threshold level, and then eat fats to satiety, you do those things and you start creating ketones over a 2 to 4 week adaptation period, your brain is going to get the fuel that it desires, and it's going to clear up so many of the brain fog. You know, people kind of walking around after lunch at work and they're going, why do I have fuzzy brain? Why am I just not thinking clearly? What's going on here? Well, you got sugar brain, and you need to run your body on fat and ketones, and it's going to operate the way it's supposed to.
That's a good explanation. So, another way to look at it is that we routinely run glucose tolerance tests on our patients at the Hoffman Center just to see how they react in relationship to a sugar challenge, which admittedly is a little artificial, but it's a surrogate for a meal, which is often laden with carbohydrates. And we see the blood sugar go up and then down, and usually it overshoots the mark. A person might come in with a blood sugar of 80, and at the end of the test have a blood sugar of 45. They have reactive hypoglycemia very, very routinely. And of course, then you really feel brain dead because, you don't have enough fuel for your brain. And then ultimately, we see a mountainous increase in insulin, which of course sucks the fat cells away in your body and has a lot of other deleterious effects and promotes another, wicked appetite for more carbohydrates. And then you're on this up and down merry-go-round. And what you're saying, I think, in essence, is that fat is a more reliable, steady-state fuel. And if you measure the blood sugar of somebody who's subsisting on a ketogenic diet, it's a pretty steady-state sugar. And so there's not a lot of ups and downs in mood, energy, and mental focus.
It is steady-state. And I would also add, probably lower than what conventional medicine would say is a normal level. I can tell you sometimes I've had blood ketone levels, 3-4 millimolar, and simultaneously my blood sugar will be in the low 60s. So a doctor would say, oh, that's hypoglycemic. But no, you don't need that much glucose when you're not a sugar burner anymore. So your body is kind of taking in the ketones. It's taking up part of what would normally be your blood sugar level. So people sometimes freak out about that when they get into ketosis. They're like, oh no, I'm in hypoglycemia because I've got 62 on my blood sugar. I'm like, no, you've replaced your body being a sugar burner and you're now a fat burner. And see, they're asymptomatic. So they're not feeling any effects of hypoglycemia, yet that number freaks them out.
So, a question that comes to mind is, is this natural? Because, we often hearken back to anthropological evidence. I think that's the basis of the paleo diet. We say, look, if we want to know what to eat, we simply should go back in time to see what the human body was adapted for. And I think the consensus is that we do eat too many carbs. But on the other hand, humans throughout their evolution were not necessarily on a ketogenic diet. We're omnivorous. There were times where we did have some carbohydrates, perhaps not in as refined or abundant a state as we have now, where we can go down to the 7-Eleven and stock up. We had to work for our carbohydrates. So is ketosis natural, or is it an aberration to force ketosis on our bodies with our genetic makeup?
Well, certainly if you're running optimally right now and you're doing well in your sugar burning state without being in a state of ketosis, rock on.
Right.
Keep doing what you're doing. But what we're talking about here are people that aren't running optimally. They're having some of these issues that we talked about earlier. And they need to come up with some sort of solution. Now, think about our Paleolithic ancestors. I know the paleo diet's gotten very popular in recent years, and I'm actually a part of that community as well. And a lot of our paleo ancestors, yes, they used glucose as their body's preferred fuel source when non-animal-based food was available. But when they were short on food, or when animal-based foods were their primary source of calories, guess what sustained them?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't sugar, because there was no sugar to be consumed. It is ketones. So it stands to reason that this is an evolutionary thing that our ancestors survived because of ketosis. So is it natural? I think if you ask those people if they survived because of it, absolutely. Otherwise, we probably would have ended as a species a very long time ago.
Well, ketosis is actually the state of starvation to some extent, is that in starvation, you preferentially burn fat, your own body's fat,
right,
or exogenous fat. Actually, there was a recent relatively modern experiment in ketogenic diet, which was the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Right.
They embarked with, you probably know this story, they embarked with rations. You know, they had hardtack and biscuits and, you know, things. But pretty soon, after this long journey up the rivers and across the mountains and, you know, across the plains, they ran out of their food. They did, however, have plenty of ammo and good guns. And most of the animals that they encountered, the bears and the elk and the bison, were sort of naive to humans. So they weren't skittish. They didn't take off. They were easy prey. And so the members of the Lewis and Clark expedition subsisted quite nicely, eating 5 to 8 pounds of meat per day.
Yeah.
And very little vegetation, virtually no carbohydrates. They were working real hard because they were pushing wagons and carrying their boats portage style across obstacles. And yet they survived. And actually, I think it was only one guy on that expedition died due to illness, and certainly not due to starvation.
Right. Yeah, and we've seen that over and over again throughout history. 1879, this guy named Frederick Schwatka was a U.S. Army lieutenant, doctor, and lawyer, and he went on an Arctic expedition looking for records of some Royal Navy ships. And so he got some Inuit, who is a very traditional culture, could be described as a ketogenic society. And so they stored just enough food to sustain them for 1 month and lots of hunting equipment, just like you were describing with Lewis and Clark. And that's how they survived. They did a lot of strenuous walking, but they ate a lot of animal-based fat and protein. In fact, now that transition from sugar burning to fat burning is known as the Schwatka imperative. It's a pretty cool thing. And then we've even seen some like news stories over the past couple of years where people have done Arctic expeditions and they bring like whole sticks of butter with them. And they'll eat the butter while they're on their trail. And of course, it's too cold for them to heat up anything. So that's how they have to sustain themselves. It shocks people that are fat phobics too.
Right.
But it's their energy source and they realize that.
Well, that would be fine with me because in my household, when I'm down to like two sticks of butter, that constitutes an emergency. That is absolutely an emergency. All right. This is a logical inflection point for us because if you remember, Jimmy, we cut our podcast into two segments. So what we're going to do is we're going to pause at this point. And when we return in part two, we're going to talk about practical implementation of the ketogenic diet. What are the considerations? How do you know if you're in ketosis? And what in the heck can you eat? Those are the subjects that we're going to talk about in part two. So stay tuned. Please join us. Our guest is Jimmy Moore. I almost called him Dr. Jimmy Moore. You should get an honorary doctorate, Jimmy.
I feel like I've got about 10 or 20 of them.
Who wrote this book with an authentic MD, Dr. Eric Westman, a top researcher in the field of diet at Duke University. The book is Keto Clarity, and we'll return in just a moment with more of Intelligent Medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.